game this afternoon. I'm not sure what the planners had in mind, but I like to think, and I'm sure it really is true, that when they looked around to see who are the best people to talk on the subject of the day, they all turned out to be women. What do you know? We do have, supposed to have, serving as a kind of umpire, and I don't know any man who is better in recognizing a foul than Jim Lotz. I didn't say chicken, I said fowl. He probably recognizes the other kind too. he will be the discussant on the subject of government and the native people, the response to change. First person is associated with both Alaska Methodist University and the Anchorage Community College branch of the University of Alaska. An anthropologist who will, and Professor Mrs. Nancy Yaw Davis, who will talk on a village view of agencies.
Chairman, should I go ahead or wait until I go?
Okay.
When this construction done, we're going to declare a 3-month vacation and none of you white folks going to come. This statement was made by a newly elected chief in a village which had experienced a year of intensive involvement in village affairs by many different agencies. He had reached a point I call agency saturation. Evidence of agency saturation is found in villagers' references to confusion over agency purposes, anger about unfulfilled promises and nominal consideration of village preferences, community-wide amusement over interagency conflicts, and increased intra-village political difficulties directly related to new problems instigated by outside intervention. Finally, the key indication of agency saturation is marked concern over apparent loss of village autonomy and an expressed desire for its return. In this paper, I have assembled a number of statements by villagers which reflect different aspects of their experience with agencies and tell us something about events which may lead to a general disillusionment with that segment of the larger world. The statements were selected from tape-recorded sessions with 75 persons in 5 North Pacific villages. Now, the primary focus of the field work in these communities was not to elicit responses about agencies. That sort of happened spontaneously. But rather, the primary focus was to learn what happened during and following the Alaskan earthquake. The research was sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council, and was directed by the Ohio State Disaster Research Center. The field work was conducted from March to May in 1965, 1 year following the natural disaster. The insights reported in this paper concerning village response to outside intervention in their affairs was a secondary outcome of the disaster research. The concept of agency saturation was derived from inspection of the original verbatim reports pertaining to specifically that year following the earthquake. This report reflects only some villagers' views of white man's involvement. No attempt is made to present agency explanations. Now, admittedly, further bias is injected by my selection of some of the choices statements. In other words, no attempt is made to acclaim the reports of these villagers are typical. Finally, this represents a composite account, composite village and a composite agency. The names of the villages, informants, and agencies are not identified. Let me begin with expressions of confusion about agency purposes, the first symptom of agency saturation. X and Y are two agencies, the speaker, a village leader. Quote, like when Y was here and they're going to give us everything, X is going to chip in and help us a little, then Y goes out and X comes in and says they're going to do everything and Y didn't do anything. They seem to want to keep us in the dark on how much was spent by Y. Each department wants to say they did it all. With this kind of uncertainty about sources of funds, the villagers wondered, who do you think when the work is done? Related to persistent puzzle about what really is going on at the agency level are reports of promises made, but their fulfillment delayed. For example, one project which villagers understood would be completed in April was begun the following August. Another project which was anticipated for May was delayed until the following September. A third project scheduled for November was canceled until the following spring. And then there was something else too that had been promised in 1960 and they still hadn't had it. Quote, if they had come out and told us that they were still waiting for money to be appropriated and all that, then we'd understand, but we didn't know what the delay was, end quote. Nominal consideration for village preferences concerning crucial decisions such as village location, housing, airstrips, created further disillusionment with agencies. For example, one agency was reported to assured village, quote, we can move wherever we want. But in fact, decisions to combine two villages were made without full awareness by the communities involved. Furthermore, an initial decision shared with residents of another community was changed twice again, the last time while the men were out fishing. As for the third village, their relocation at the same pre-disaster site was a fait accompli before a token inspection visit to the area by the village leaders was made. For those who disliked the decision, quote, that agency wouldn't do anything for them that wanted to move. They had to do whatever they were told to do, end quote. Disregard for village values pertaining to location of houses and lots dismayed many. One community, which is formerly housed along a beach, had their new homes put amongst the trees. Another village, which formerly had been surrounded with trees, was relocated up on the tundra. A third village, whose residents relished a view of the beach, was arranged in six suburban-like rows, with only a few houses afforded a view. Observed one home owner, quote, "I really liked to watch out the window and see the boats, the tides, and the airplanes, and the people that used to walk on the beach." Now what he could see was other houses. Local values concerning housing were not considered. Preferences for porches and storage space, large kitchens and steam baths were apparently unsolicited or disregarded. In one village, a plan for housing had been presented by an agency and accepted by the villagers. And 10 days later, the plan was changed by the agency, and the villagers, under threat, as they interpreted it, under threat of receiving no housing at all, reluctantly accepted the new plan. The council notes cautiously state, quote, "General feeling is poor for this plan, but will have to accept the house according to the size of family," end quote. The building of the new houses suffered many delays and caused numerous difficulties within the communities. Village men were expected to do menial tasks under white bosses for no pay. In some cases, they refused to work and received a great deal of verbal abuse by the well-paid outside carpenters. Time was lost and cost went up. Later, a villager commented, quote, "They don't want to pay the people to build their own homes, but they would have saved quite a bit of tax money if they did pay them and let them build them and build them the way they wanted them. We could have been in our house long before," end quote. In one community with limited area for building enough houses between the beach and the mountain, an airstrip was extended and improved, cutting into scarce village space. A signed release was required. Again, under threat that the rebuilding of the village would be held up, permission was obtained. However, from the village point of view, quote, "They just took that strip, that's all. We didn't have no say, no so whatsoever. They pushed that airstrip down our throats. This report got in that we wanted that airstrip, but everybody here wanted a boat harbor, because they need a boat harbor. No boat harbor, that's yet to come. And everybody has boats. There isn't one airplane in the village." A third indication of agency saturation is found in acuity of observation of interagency problems. For example, the following statements indicate an awareness of interagency difficulties. Quote, "Sometimes bosses get along and they're eating dinner together. Then someone else comes and there's daggers back and forth." From the villager standpoint, if an outside person gets along with the villagers, he gets fired. Note, however, that a person referred to in the next quote was given an award by his agency for his accomplishments. Quote, "He's still running around here like a chicken with his head cut off. Comes in and he looks around, then he seems to go back. The big report. He never talks to anyone here. I don't see him do anything," end quote. Agency inefficiency is not ignored. Quote, "There are so many guys coming in and going out on each of the projects that by the time they got around to doing the project, they were short of funds," end quote. Interagency conflict appears most obvious when more than one agency is working simultaneously in the same village. Then, for example, the fact that one has a machine, like a digging machine, that the other agency needs but cannot use without much red tape and communication to faraway places. This becomes quite puzzling and also amusing. In the village way of life, of course, sharing of goods and equipment is expected. Also, it is reported if more than one agency is in the village and problems develop, one agency will blame the other one, setting up a chain of reciprocal scapegoating. Quote, I think the village here gets along a lot better than some of those outfits. They're blaming each other for everything. End quote. Perhaps the most candid commentary on modern bureaucracy is found in this statement. There's just too many departments, and departments with heads that can't get along with each other. It seems to me like they are a couple little girls fighting over paper dolls. Seems to me there are a couple little girls fighting over paper dolls. Now, in addition to increased tensions and conflict between individual villagers and outsiders, you know, how to cope with strangers is a special phenomenon that you learn in modernization. Now, there are internal village center problems which tend to increase as a result of outside intervention. For example, many villagers commented on how no one would speak up at a meeting when the agency personnel was there. But as soon as he left, the community, all hell would break loose. As one person said, quote, these people here don't like to go up and argue with them people, so they start arguing among themselves. In one village, the chief was reportedly regularly beaten up after an agency man left, the complaint being he didn't speak up enough. This introduces the topic of leadership qualifications and the special demands put on them whenever any major project or program or other innovation is introduced in a small community. On the one hand, characteristics of a good chief for the outside world might include reading and writing English, efficiency, skill at diffusing information and eliciting decisions from somewhere, reporting decisions, and of course, ability to get the council together on short notice, you know, before the plane leaves, and behaving with appropriate deference in the presence of visiting officials. Now, on the other hand, the key qualifications from the village standpoint might include a different set of qualifications, such as the ability to speak the native language, high moral conduct, a reputation as a good fisherman, not pushy and not demanding, plus the ability to talk back to the white man and simultaneously to be willing to take the blame for everything that goes wrong. Now, in one case, information that a barge with building material was arriving in a village, and this was heard over the radio, and men quit fishing a little early and to be home in time to help unload. They arrived in the village and discovered, after waiting 2 days, the barge was not expected for another 18 days. Commented a leader caught in this situation, quote, that's when the people got all frustrated and disgusted and started hacking at one another because they had all these promises. And then I had to tell it to them, and they kind of blamed it on me. And I tried to keep them calmed down. And then I called them, the agency, and they handed me another phony lie. The problem of being a leader in a small community with an egalitarian ethic may be further compounded by attempts of favoritism by visiting persons. An official came in and offered to build the chief a model home. The chief recalls, I told him, see that tree over there? Do you want me to hang up from there? You finish mine last. Fix one of those big family houses first. He was going to make a model home out of mine. Boy, oh boy, was I scared. Now, in addition to stresses felt by individual leaders, the council may have many new demands and responsibilities as a result of the new projects and programs. For example, traditional topics handled by the council may be, as in one village, limited to elections, resignations, and once-a-year cleanup activities. To this was suddenly added responsibility for setting ordinances for the use of lots, rules for leasing of lots, billing and collecting of utility bill fees, maintenance of new utilities, selection of persons for new jobs made available locally, and now this may include many programs, so Head Start, health aids, welfare aids, teacher aids, VISTA aids, and others. Not only was the council given additional responsibility, but also they were required to meet frequently and often on extremely short notice. In a six-month period, one village recorded 21 meetings. 9 of these were formally designated as council meetings, as distinguished from meetings initiated by visiting officials. By the fourth month, all attempts to have a separate council meeting were abandoned, and the agency person assigned to the community apparently directed affairs, including calling meetings and writing all necessary letters. But before this happened, during that four-month period, council records reflect 6 attempts to resign by council members. 3 resignations were accepted and 3 rejected. Now, the reasons for these resignations were varied, but in each case, the cause was directly related to agency involvement in the community. For example, the secretary resigned 4 days after election. The day before her resignation, that's 3 days after she was elected, 2 meetings had been called on the spur of the moment by outside officials. One meeting lasted 1.5 hours, and the other 2 hours. She resigned the following day. In another case, a council member dared to tell an agency person, quote, he should live up to that promise, this was concerning housing, or not make any promises at all, end quote. The villager then resigned from the council for fear he had jeopardized the village in its tenuous relationship with that agency. Once a report went to Anchorage stating the villagers were not cooperating on a project. As a result, another council member attempted to resign. Still another person, suffering as a buffer between agency and villagers, attempted to resign, but was convinced by his council to keep the job because, quote, if he did that, then his resign, that might jeopardize the work by showing that we couldn't keep one leader in the village. So we decided we'd better talk him into it, end quote. Such resignations and attempted resignations may be one mechanism devised for coping with the additional demands made on council members. From these few quotations, several facts may be learned about the effects of outside intervention on the internal workings of a small community. Agencies, by their presence, can unknowingly redirect conflict and create new areas of conflict and radically disturb former social interrelationships, all in the name of establishing modernity. More complete analysis of the effects might indicate that villages attracting and receiving the most help from the outside world are the ones that appear to have the greatest degree of disorganization and internal conflict. The worse the local condition appears, the more people send out to help, which aggravates the situation. For each new white person, regardless of his stated purpose, speaks perhaps a very common message by his presence, and that is, you have a problem here, and I know what it is, and I'm here to help you. One way to look at village agency contacts is in terms of patron-client relationships, which have a long history in Alaska. For example, in 5 villages in my study, a serf-like relationship was first established with the Russian fur trading companies early in the 19th century. Later, loyalties to a single fur company were shifted to single cannery companies. As an example of long-established patron-client contractual relationship, one man continues to work for the same cannery because, and I quote, when the company knows there's a good season, credit's wide open, can have anything you want, but if the season slacks down, they cut down, and if in the you sell to too many companies, they'll not accept your fish in a heavy run. They'll tell you to go to a different company. You treat them good, and they'll treat you good. End quote. The same kind of reciprocal obligations and expectations may generalize into village relationships with all outside institutions. If the villagers as clients are good and compliant, the patrons will deal kindly with them. When a large number of different agencies enter a village, the result may be an increased number of tenuous patron-client ties with the outside world, giving rise to some ambiguous feelings by some individuals about the associated invasion in former village and personal privacy. And here's some questions that we might think about in terms of this analysis. That is, what is the tolerance level in Village Alaska for the number of patron-client ties? How often might a village experience agency saturation? What evidence might there be that other communities are nearing a saturation point in their client relationships with outsiders? Is my study an isolated example? Or has the increase of programs and projects since 1965 placed even more villages closer to the point of agency saturation? Now, in summary, each of the symptoms of what I call agency saturation may occur in any village experiencing extensive outside intervention in local affairs. Confusion over real purposes, concern about consideration of village preferences, village jokes about agency personnel, and increased intervillage political conflict may be widespread as a result of the numerous projects and programs currently being introduced in Village Alaska. And the symptoms may occur without the obvious presence of the disease. My contention here is that when all these symptoms are found simultaneously in one community and can be verbalized by the residents to a Gusick or an outsider, as I was, then a convincing case of agency saturation can be made. When the above conditions are met and accompanied with statements such as, I wonder when they're going to stop coming here and telling us what to do, and once they get away from us and everyone gets back in themselves, when you come back, it'll be a fine village. Then you have a convincing case of a community suffering from agency saturation and ready to declare a moratorium on outside invasion of personal and village privacy. We're gonna declare a 3-month vacation and none of you white folks come. Now, in conclusion, we may wish to speculate what the implications an increasing rate of agency saturation may have on the future of village agency relationships. Perhaps express concern about regaining and retaining village autonomy will hopefully occur simultaneously with the rise of local political entrepreneurs, the decentralization of decision-making bodies, and an equitable settlement of the land rights. Then villagers perhaps will experience a creative break away from the inhibiting patron-client ties and a chance to learn of decision-making skills on the village level and the regaining of village autonomy in their own affairs. Perhaps they'll discover it is possible to participate economically without losing their identity or their dignity. What many villages have experienced thus far is much meddling and little money. What they need is money without meddling.
I want to apologize for the overcrowdedness of this. We expected, I think, about two-thirds of the number of people who actually arrived at the science conference. And the other halls are closed. So we'd like to say right now that if anybody outside is willing to sit here on the floor, they're welcome to come in. And if anyone sitting on chairs wouldn't mind terribly sitting on the floor, I'm sure there's some people outside that would come.
Come on in, there's some more chairs.
There's no more chairs, one back here.
There's some here.
This is going to be your last chance.
There's some up here.
Windows open. Can people by the windows open them anymore?
Let's see. One is open. They're open.
There's a chair here. I think there's a chair over in that room too. Someone take that one. There's one in the middle. One more chair in the middle, and then we're going to start. There's another chair over in here.
Okay, thank you. On the subject of agency-community conflict, we have Mrs. Dorothy Jones, who has recently become Dr. Jones. Her home is in Cold Bay. I have just learned that after Christmas, is that correct? After Christmas you'll be here?
Yes.
So she and her husband will be here. And that's good news to many of you, I'm sure. So, Mrs. Jones. Dr. Jones, excuse me.
Thank you.
I wonder if we should have called this panel Let's Take On the Agency Panel. My subject, my paper deals with a similar theme. The emphasis is on the sources of conflict between three specific government agencies, health, education, and welfare, and an Alaskan Native community. The paper is based on an ethnographic study of Unalaska, a remote Aleut community of roughly 250 persons. Unalaska is similar to other Native communities, as Bob Arnold discussed it yesterday for those of you who heard him, with the exception that a money economy dominates there and subsistence activities have nearly disappeared. 200 years of white contact in Unalaska have effectively destroyed Aboriginal culture, and in its place have brought a boom and bust industrial economy. even at the height of boom periods, such as the current one in the crab industry, the Aleut has had opportunity only for menial, low-paying, and intermittently available jobs. So he is a marginal man in a dual sense, both to his traditional culture and to modern industrial society. My paper then will focus on the responses of a culturally and economically marginal group to the policies and practices of health, education, and welfare agencies. We turn first to discussion of the school and the community. Unalaska, as an incorporated city, operates an independent school district, which includes an elementary and high school, subject to the policies and regulations of the State Department of Education. Alaska's policy toward the education of natives, which has remained relatively unchanged since the passage of the first Organic Act in 1884, emphasizes assimilation into white urban society. This policy has been largely ineffective in Unalaska. There is a nearly universal and abiding antagonism to the school and to the teachers. The antagonism is expressed in complaints about the teachers' low academic expectations, intrusive and offensive behavior, and use of cruel punishments. It is expressed in a student norm of resistance and defiance. In the words of an elementary grade student, quote, "It would be embarrassing to be good in school. Everyone's bad except the white kids." And the antagonism is reflected, whether as cause or effect, in a strikingly high rate of school failures. Nearly 60% of the 1967 Aleut student body had failed one or more grades, and the vast majority of high school students drop out before graduation. The ineffectiveness of the Unalaska school system may be attributed to a number of factors, such as its isolation and inferior teachers in plant. But the most significant factor appears to inhere in the education policy itself and some of the assumptions underlying that policy. A policy advocating the transmission of an alien and unfamiliar culture implies that the culture being transmitted is superior to or more desirable than that being replaced. A corollary assumption is that manifestations of the native culture hinder the achievement of the educational objectives and therefore must be exorcised. To this end, most teachers in Unalaska have prohibited the speaking of the Aleut language, omit any curriculum references to Aleut or other native history and traditions, and disparage Aleut customs and behavior. Moreover, because the culture, and therefore its carriers, is viewed as inferior, the teachers tend to treat Aleut students as less educable and intelligent than their white counterparts. As one former student phrased it, "They never taught us to value education. They brainwashed us into believing we were not capable. They never expected us to study, and I never cracked a book," end quotes. Another said, "When we graduated eighth grade, we knew we couldn't make it in a regular high school." Recent studies have shown that the low academic expectations, characteristic of teachers in low-income neighborhoods, foredoom students to a career of failure. The operation of this process in places like Unalaska imposes an additional handicap on children who already face a competitive disadvantage in the larger society. School failure and alienation in Unalaska, however, cannot be attributed only to the teachers' low academic expectations and the system of tracking failures. They also reflect a disparity between the promise and reality of American education in Native communities. The manifest purpose of that education is to equip students for full participation in the wider society. Yet, however well equipped, because of racial and cultural differences, the Aleut is denied full access to that world, as the experiences of most Aleut emigrants demonstrates. And in the native village, regardless of educational attainment, he is restricted to a marginal economic status. Consequently, the Unalaska Aleut is uncertain and ambivalent about a school system which requires his allegiance, while at the same time it undermines his cultural identity, morale, and self-respect, and which promises effective academic and economic competition in the absence of equal educational and economic opportunities. We turn next to discussion of public health and the community, and I want to point out that the purpose of this discussion is not to underestimate the remarkable record of the Alaska Public Health Service, but to highlight those aspects which undermine its service. The Alaska Native Service of the U.S. Public Health Service carries the major responsibility for Native health care in the state. This service in Unalaska consists of semi-annual field clinics, occasional visits by a dentist, phone communication with an Anchorage public health physician, and hospitalization in Anchorage, roughly 700 miles away. But it provides no consistent follow-up care after hospitalization, no regular pre- or postnatal care, no nursing care for the chronically ill, no rehabilitation services for the disabled, and no expert on hand to manage day-to-day health crises. Unalaskans became accustomed to a full range of services in the 1930s when a Bureau of Indian Affairs hospital operated there, and the community considers the restoration of resident health services and facilities its single most crucial health need. But the Alaska Native Service emphasizes centralized urban treatment facilities. Though the ANS has the specific responsibility for the health care of a Native population, the majority of which lives in small, remote, and usually impoverished villages, its programs are seemingly designed by middle-class urban persons and incorporate a model of the middle-class urban patient, the conventional doctor-patient relationship, and the urban hospital as the central treatment facility. This model of service may be of dubious application in places like Unalaska. The Unalaska Aleut, accustomed to highly personal village relationships, tends to be alienated by the medical professional's usual impersonal manner. He often interprets this manner as evidence of disinterest, which reinforces his general distrust of dominant society agencies. Moreover, frequently medically ill-informed and unfamiliar with hospital procedures, he may need more time and personal explanation than other types of patients. For example, one patient feared they were going to staple her to the examining table when extracting spinal fluid. Another feared a murder attempt when receiving her first intravenous injection. The agency emphasis on the urban treatment center creates severe strain in a community distant from that center. Many, never or rarely having left the village before, must face a host of unfamiliar situations. The airplane, the city, the large impersonal hospital, different modes of dress, different noise levels, and a different temporal synchronization. A number of these hospitalizations involving disorders that might be treated in a local or regional facility if such were available produce unnecessary economic hardship in a poor community. This is especially stressful in view of the welfare agency's practice of granting emergency assistance only for absences exceeding 2 months. Hospitalization distant from home may also threaten disruption of the family because the state health foster care program operates only in the cities of Anchorage and Fairbanks. One widowed mother of 12 refused hospitalization despite warning she would not survive without it. She feared the welfare agency would remove her children from the community and place them in strange cities, which it did after she died. One of the most discouraging features of the public health program in a poor community such as Unalaska is the agency's failure to treat the manifold conditions producing ill health. Many parents are reluctant to follow a doctor's recommendation, for example, to bathe children frequently, when the children live in small, overcrowded, rat-infested houses, drink contaminated water, may sleep in airless, congested rooms, and may eat only one meal a day. Yet, because of limited funds and the lack of coordination between health and related services, the agency is unable to deal with these underlying conditions. These two factors, the fragmented organization of agency services and the agency's commitment to a model of service inappropriate to Unalaska, engenders antagonism and resistance in members of the community. Thus, the agency fails either to win allegiance to its concept of service or to provide a service responsive to the expressed needs and desires of the community. Finally, we turn to a discussion of child welfare practices in the community. I have dealt with child welfare problems in Unalaska in another paper, and here I shall examine only one and the major source of conflict between agency and community. Problems of abused, neglected, and homeless children have become acute in Unalaska in recent years, according to both the community and the agency. In a single year, 1967, nearly one-fourth of Unalaska's Aleut children, 16 years of age and under, were removed from the community by the Alaska Division of Public Welfare, which carries the major responsibility for child welfare services in the state. The agency emphasis on placement of children is not unique to Alaska, but when applied to remote Native communities from which a majority of Alaska's child welfare cases come, it means placement distant from the village in culturally alien and unfamiliar environments. Because of the breakdown in traditional authority structures and the failure of new ones to emerge, members of the community feel impotent to manage some of their child welfare problems, such as cases of severe child abuse. Yet they hesitate to call on the agency because of its nearly universal practice of removing children from the community, whether or not the community feels able to manage the problem. To illustrate this point, the family of the widowed mother of 12 referred to earlier was a public assistance recipient, and therefore the agency assumed responsibility for placing the children after the mother's death. Yet in this case, the community members wanted and felt able to manage the placements. In fact, prior to the arrival of the agency social worker, homes had been provided for all the children. The social worker evaluated these homes on a model of the urban middle-class family, the size of homes, the financial potential of the breadwinner, the parents' ability to plan for the children's futures, and the parents' ability to verbalize feelings. These standards are clearly irrelevant in a community characterized by poverty, an unstable economy, a culture group whose members tend to be verbally reticent, especially with outsiders, and a people who do not necessarily view the future as an asset. On the basis of these standards, the social worker rated every local home unsatisfactory and removed the 7 youngest children from the community. To the children involved, such placements mean severing ties with everyone and everything familiar. To their families, they mean, as these persons repeatedly stated, but we might never see them again. To members of the community who hold firmly to the traditional ideal of community responsibility for the welfare of children, such placements serve as one more bitter reminder of the failure of their institutions and organizations. Again, we see that agency programs and practices developed in an urban environment and oriented to middle-class standards have become so firmly entrenched that despite the realities of life in Village Alaska, the agency is blinded to alternative approaches. If agency services prove ineffective, the agency seemingly concludes not that something is wrong with these services, but that it needs to expand them. To the community, the issue is not more professional services, but a different type of service aimed at creating indigenous organizations through which the community could fulfill its ideals regarding the care of children. In conclusion, I've discussed the conflicting and widely divergent conceptions of 3 government agencies and a community which is poor and ethnically distinct. Closing this gap is not merely a matter of substituting community goals for those of the agency. Community members are themselves ambivalent about their goals because they are marginal to 2 cultures, in both of which they lack faith. Resolving this dilemma is contingent on opportunities for full participation in the larger society, or for evolving satisfying alternatives in the Aboriginal setting, or for both. It also depends on opportunities for active participation in shaping and implementing the policies and programs that affect their lives. But such opportunities, which should constitute the major goals of the agencies serving places like Unalaska, are lacking. This lack may be attributed to 2 conditions. The first concerns the fractionated organization of services for the poor. Health, education, and welfare problems, though inextricably entwined in real life, are assigned to separate agencies, each independent of and with few ties to the other, thereby hindering the development of comprehensive and coordinated attacks on problems. Moreover, the compartmentalization of services forces a preoccupation with the competition for scarce resources, thus riveting the agency's attention to survival needs and diverting it from its central purposes. The second condition refers to the values underlying agency policies. The agencies operate on a set of assumptions, frequently implicit, rarely tested, but which have over time assumed the status of solid truths. 4 such assumptions appear to underlie the policies and programs of the agencies discussed in this paper. 1, that a uniform rather than a plural cultural model is the desideratum. 2, that unacculturated persons prefer integrating into the dominant society to maintaining their subcultures. 3, that low-level jobs represent a stepping stone to better jobs. And 4, that the persistence of a marginal economic status reflects not on the structural conditions producing it, but on the adequacy of the individuals involved. The assumption that urban industrial society represents the single desirable cultural route insulates the agency from information about the unique needs, aspirations, and potentials of the people served. Convinced the problem lies within these people, the agencies bend every effort to reform them and remold them in terms of behavior expectations and standards the people have little opportunity to exercise and which they may not desire. Why are these assumptions so firmly implanted when they seem to result in neglectful, ineffective, irrelevant, and frequently offensive programs? First, these assumptions, representing values of the larger society, are transmitted by institutions of that society, and so agency staff has been socialized according to them. Second, these assumptions did not arise in a vacuum. They stem from an earlier period in American history when the European immigrant wanted to and succeeded in integrating into the dominant society. But during that period, the society needed and rewarded his unskilled labor. This model is increasingly inappropriate as the economy automates and the market for unskilled labor shrinks. Emulation of dominant society norms and values no longer necessarily leads to integration in and acceptance by the larger society. In fact, the efforts of unskilled rural minority migrants to assimilate in the city are proving detrimental to both the city and the migrants. The third reason for the persistence of these assumptions is a tendency noted by most organization analysts for agency personnel to develop vested interests in agency status quo because it is habitual and because it assures the continued need for their skills. To protect these vested interests, agencies tend to eschew information that might upset the value, the balance, and consequently they fail to structure feedback mechanisms that might lead to change. In sum, we have suggested 2 major sources of agency-community conflict. The first is the fragmented organization of services for the poor, which prevents the design and implementation of coherent and coordinated attacks on problems. The second refers to the ideological misconceptions underlying agency policies. These misconceptions concern the nature and sources of poverty, the meaning of life in isolated rural communities, and the aspirations of culturally and racially distinct populations. As a result of these conditions, agency policies are ambiguous and fail to settle the fundamental policy question of whether to really let the natives in or whether to really let them out so they can evolve their own cultural styles. Thank you.